are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 23, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robert Kuttner. On the stakes, 2020 and the survival of American democracy. Also on the program today, Trump admits soliciting Ukrainian election help, but it's okay. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi pretends like she might allow impeachment to move forward. Elizabeth Warren takes the lead in an Iowa poll. Bernie in a dead heat in New Hampshire. Are we nearing a Joe Biden free fall? Speaking of free falling, Cory Booker announces he has 8 days to raise $2 million. We'll have to quit the race. UN looking to push for more climate action as they get a lashing from a teenage girl. Deserved. Well done. Not my daughter. Meanwhile, Modi campaigns with Donald Trump, meaning Kashmir can expect no help from the United States.
Also, Tulsi says mahalo. Literally tweeted that out.
Oh, jeez. Bureau of Land Management moves out of D.C. and into offices alongside oil and gas companies. Literally.
Drain the swamp.
All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. First off, allow me to apologize. There's something going on with my voice. I'm not quite sure what it is. I don't know if I have like a cold, a nascent cold, or I just slept on my face incorrectly at one point over the weekend. I'm not sure. So forgive me. We are also skeleton crew today. Just Matt and Brendan here with us.
It's the efficiency crew.
It is the efficiency crew. I would have to say that, like, if we're going to have a skeleton, that's the skeleton I would want. I don't know what parts of the skeleton are the most important parts of the skeleton, really. But that's a good thing. So you're in good hands, ladies and gentlemen. Another week. This one should be interesting. There are significant calls for the impeachment of Donald Trump. We have now about, what is it, like 140 some odd Democratic Congress people who have signaled that they want to move forward with impeachment of Donald Trump publicly. That is prior to all this stuff about the whistleblower. On Thursday, the Director of National Intelligence, McGuire, acting, I guess, right? They're all acting, will testify in front of the House Intelligence Committee, public testimony. And the question will be, will he hand over the whistleblower complaint and allow for the whistleblower to come and testify to Congress? Now, remember, the Donald Trump appointed Inspector General of the Directorate of National Intelligence has deemed this whistleblower complaint to be valid enough to trigger the statute that requires its reporting to Congress. There is simply no legitimate argument about this. I mean, I haven't seen a single legal scholar who is named come out and say, like, well, no. And so there's no question here that this type of stonewalling should in and of itself be enough for impeachment. Here is Donald Trump. Here's two clips. We have a Donald Trump. Which one? Which should we play the other one first? Yeah. Now, I think this is at the UN. And this is where he discusses, I think it's at the UN, where he discusses, maybe both of these are, where he discusses this phone call, which the Wall Street Journal Friday afternoon reported there were 8 times where Trump asked a question for something. We should remind you that Donald Trump, well, listen to this.
We had a perfect phone call with the president of Ukraine. Everybody knows it. It's just a Democrat witch hunt. Here we go again. They failed with Russia. They failed with recession. They failed with everything. And now they're bringing this up. The one who's got the problem is Biden. Because you look at what Biden did. Biden did what they would like to have me do, except for one problem. I didn't do it. What Biden did is a disgrace. What his son did is a disgrace. The son took money from Ukraine. The son took money from China. A lot of money from China.
Okay. So there's Donald Trump pivoting from it was a nice conversation with the president of Ukraine. And but what I did, what they're accusing me of doing is actually what Biden did. Last night, Donald Trump tweets out that it was a nice call, right? I mean, the fake news media says I pressured the Ukrainian president at least 8 times during my phone call with him. Now, I don't know what that means. You pressured him 8 times. It sounds like he specifically asked a specific question. I don't know how you enumerate 8 pressure points.
It'd be nice to see that transcript.
It would be actually very helpful, I think, for the president for us to see this. This supposedly comes from a so-called whistleblower who they say doesn't even have a firsthand account of what was said. More Democrat crooked media con. Breaking news, the Ukrainian government just said they weren't pressured at all during a nice call. Sleepy Joe Biden, on the other hand, forced a tough prosecutor out of investigating the son's company. We'll talk about that a little bit later. That's the real story. So that's it. It was just a nice call. There was no pressuring. They just talked about nice things, you know, like you're a good guy. Be good. Good is good.
Let's be appropriate.
Be appropriate. Watch your language. And today at the United Nations, Trump seems to like sort of pivot off that a little bit.
What did you get with the Ukrainian president about Joe Biden and his son? Your
phone call. Well, you're going to see, because what we are doing is we want honesty. And if we deal with a country, we want honesty. And I think with the new president, you're going to see much more honesty in the Ukraine. And that's what we're looking for. We're supporting a country. We want to make sure that country is honest. It's very important to talk about corruption. If you don't talk about corruption, why would you give money to a country that you think is corrupt? One of the reasons the new president got elected is he was going to stop corruption. So it's very important that on occasion you speak to somebody about corruption. Very important.
Okay. Now, I don't know how your nice phone calls go, but buried in that jibber jabber was an ultimatum. If you're going to want to, if you're going to support a country, you want them to be honest. Now, on most of my nice phone calls, I don't question the honesty of the people I'm talking to. And then to the extent that I am questioning the honesty, I don't necessarily say, and I'm not going to give you the support that I've given you in the past because I suspect you're dishonest. I just want you to root out corruption. And I'm going to say that 8 times and dangle money in front of you. He almost admits he's like walking up to the line. This is what I surmise is happening. They are very concerned that at one point this transcript is going to get out there by hook or crook. And what he is now already doing is trying to reinterpret the transcript. So when I was saying, you better do this or you're not going to get the money, I was just saying, be honest. Now, the problem that Trump has is that everybody knows he's a complete pathological liar. The one possible saving grace he has is that the one means of holding him to account, and by this I don't mean Donald Trump is going to be walked out of office. That's not going to happen. Politically, being held to account, in other words, perhaps paying a price politically for doing this, the one thing that could make that happen or that could prevent that from happening is Nancy Pelosi right now. The difference between the Democratic Party not holding him to account and the Republican Party not holding him to account, if you don't understand that dynamic, maybe I can't explain it to you, but it is so massive and so obvious in the context of a two-party political system heading into a presidential election year. Right now, Donald Trump's criminal behavior is on Nancy Pelosi because she is next in line to respond to it. Nobody else can. She is the only one now who can say, we're going to take the brakes off of this impeachment stuff, or we're going to keep the brakes on. That's it. There's no one else. Mitch McConnell is not on the hook for this until Nancy Pelosi does her job. That's just the reality of this politics. Not to mention the idea that the Speaker of the House is not going to give cover to whomever is the Democratic nominee. And by cover, I simply mean not to cover up their wrongdoing, if there was any wrongdoing. And frankly, I don't know that there was. But political cover. We can see what's going on. The New York Times is reporting this literally in the first paragraph of their story on Joe Biden. Is the Times has no evidence of anything that was corrupt or any law breaking. And then it just goes on to talk about it for paragraphs. And but the fact of the matter is it's a fairly nuanced situation in which I think very hard to say that there's no sort of structural corruption here, because there is. But it's not illegal. And I'm not apologizing for it at all. I think if it was up to me, it would be disqualifying only because it is a huge liability going into an election like this. And the fact of the matter is, I think like with other candidates, if there was a similar dynamic, I don't think it would be as problematic, to be honest with you. But here's the deal. Let's just get this out of the way. So Joe Biden's son, Hunter, is being paid at one point something like $50,000 a month to sit on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. Now, I don't know what Hunter Biden's specialty is, but I would be very, very hard pressed to believe that Hunter Biden had some type of like doctorate in Ukrainian energy markets or supplies. But his father at the time was vice president. Is that illegal? No. Is it corrupt in the way that our government has become corrupted, like broadly? Yes. Does that mean that Joe Biden did anything wrong? No. In fact, it appears from the reporting now that what Joe Biden was doing was pushing out or helping to push out a prosecutor whom other governments including the U.S. Government, felt was not doing enough to pursue corruption. In fact, this prosecutor had suspended the investigation on the company that Hunter Biden was working for. And Joe Biden was pushing this guy out for a prosecutor who would be more aggressive in going after this corruption. Now, it's quite possible that Joe Biden was doing this with the knowledge of, like, I can push for this. We need less corruption there and my son will be fine. You know, there was probably nothing illicit about at all about him being paid this money. But we all know why it was. It was because they were hoping to get influence. That's the problem we have with lobbying. That's the problem that we have with paid speeches. That's the problem we have with all this. But it's not nearly as illicit as what Donald Trump has done. And so the question is, like, how do you, if Joe Biden ends up being the nominee, how do you deal with this? And for Nancy Pelosi to be sitting on her duff, protecting, or what she thinks is protecting some of these frontline Democrats in the House, which I think is dubious, particularly based upon all the data, is absurd. It's absurd. Playing this type of defense, this defensive posture, this four corners that they're playing is going to hurt the Democrats. And I mean, if it was up to me, I would say Joe Biden drop out, because the reality is the media is not fair. This sucks. It's not a good look. And this is too important of an election. And the problem that Joe Biden has that is unique to Joe Biden, because if Bernie Sanders' son was getting paid by the same company, I think it would be far less of a problem. If Elizabeth Warren, if Pete Buttigieg's husband was being paid by the same company in the same fashion, I think it would be less of a problem. Pick whoever, whatever candidate it is. The problem that Joe Biden has is, what is Joe Biden running on? I'm not corrupt. Donald Trump is corrupt. He's undercutting American values. I'm not going to do that. He is besmirching the office. I will restore its dignity. The problem is Joe Biden is running on his personal attributes and character and his integrity, and this strikes to the heart of that. All the other candidates, not all, but for the vast majority of them, are running on a series of policy platforms. Some I like, some I don't like, whatever. Their candidacy is not so contingent upon who they are as individuals. Trump is going to try and do it. He's going to try and do it. He's going to say crazy Bernie, or he's going to say, you know, Pocahontas. Or he's going to say, you know, what does he say about Buttigieg? Like
Little Pete
or whatever it is. He's going to attack them as their individual, as individuals. But the problem he has with that is that these people actually have policy sets and they're basing their campaigns on that. Joe Biden's not. That's why Joe Biden has a liability that's unique to him. And Nancy Pelosi is exacerbating it. This is just incompetence by, frankly, a generation of Democrats, but it's really a generational mindset that these two Democratic leaders are stuck in. And it's going to screw us all, frankly. Good time to talk to Robert Kuttner about the stakes in 2020 today. Before we do, you know, you spend 1/3 of your life in your sheets, right? I guess I'm not going to make any comments about others who do.
But, sometimes it's more.
Right. Don't you want them to be insanely comfortable? I do. I love my sheets, and they've been named the winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. But guess what? I don't need Good Housekeeping to tell me this. Brooklinen offers luxury sheets, towels, bedding, and more without the luxury markup. I just got a Brooklinen pillow, too. I don't mention that here, but I got a pillow. Over 20 plus colors and patterns you can mix and match. These sheets don't just feel great, they look great too. It's true. My whole bedding game has been elevated, not just from a I can sleep better perspective, but it also looks better. I have sheets that look like an adult now. And I'm not terribly consistent with my washing, but I can mix and match with these things. They all seem to go together, or at least I think I did a fairly decent job of picking a couple of different sets that fit nicely. Super comfortable. They're the most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. High quality. I got the cool, crisp, classic cotton ones. Their towels have turned my bathroom into a spa. My pillow, it's hard to find a pillow I like. I love it. Couldn't recommend them more. Friends, family, treating yourself to an upgrade you deserve. And now brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just my listeners. Get 10% off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get 10% off and free shipping is to use promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. All of these products I use today. That's the thing, is that I've rejected, I think, four different advertisers this past week. Some because it's just industries that we won't do. I'm not going to name any names, but I'm not going to do a chemical company that used to belong to another chemical company that has done some bad things to the environment. I'm not going to do any financial services or, you know, anything to that ilk. And then I have some like retail things that like I've tried the product. I didn't like it and I don't want to push it. But these I use. Not only do I sleep, I eat. And nutrition's on everybody's minds. People are trying to eat better. What, when, and how much to eat. It's a mess of conflicting information. It can confuse anybody. Kettlebell Kitchen knows that meal planning isn't one size fits all. It's why they offered a personalized solution. This is, I feel like, is something that's also like super millennial too. It's the convenience I really like about this too. Kettlebell's kitchen goal is to achieve yours with meal plans that are tailored to your needs. You can sign up for a plan or order a la carte. No long-term contracts required. Food is delivered to your door twice a week. All their meals are dairy-free, soy-free, artificial sweetener-free, and made from ingredients that are naturally free of gluten. You can even filter your choices by calorie, by protein, by fat, by carb limits, so you get exactly the right food for your unique needs. So when I'm not with the kids, this is how I've been eating. I don't have time to make as much food. I'm not as dedicated. And when I'm with the kids, I make the food more. But when I'm alone, I want to be able to eat a good meal. And I don't want to have to worry about, like, I'm trying to get a little more fit. Sometimes I fall off the wagon a little bit with cookies in the studio. But Kettlebell Kitchen has been extremely helpful. And I think it's going to be a much bigger part of my diet going forward. They got stuff like you can get Huevo Rancho, Ranchos. What do you call that? Huevos Rancheros. And I had these wild salmon cakes. They give you greens. They give you wild salmon cakes. They got like chicken Waldorf. They got some vegetarian offers if you want. All, and you can do it like a keto meal or just a heavy protein meal. You can completely structure these things. Feed the champion in you with Kettlebell Kitchen. Go to kettlebellkitchen.com. Enter the code MAJORITY for $50 off your first two orders for new customers. That's $50 off your first two orders at kettlebellkitchen.com. Code MAJORITY. As always, check out our podcast notes for links to this. And lastly, this is a golden age of television and podcasts. Everybody understands the value of a compelling narrative. Cue Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. This is pretty awesome. So you get in each, they call it seasons, right? Because it's sort of structured like a murder mystery. You get 6 episodes per season. And with each one, you dive deeper into like the feeling of being a detective. They send you documents. They send you evidence, case files. You've got to go through this and figure it out. You're not staring at a screen. You can build, the bulletin board, the investigation board with friends, or you can do it online if you need to. But you help each other through every challenge. I'm doing it with my kid, but it's also, I think, something that like people used to, you know, have like a little parlor game type of situation. You get a little bit older. Maybe that's like a boomer thing. I don't know. I'm joking. Plus, part of the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation to help fund cold case investigations. It's a lot of fun. It's nice to do like a game that is really sort of compelling. And Milo was like a big SVU fan, not SVU, Law and Order, just the generic Law and Order. And I was like, are you into this? She was. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hard to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Head over to the website. You can see what this is all about. It's pretty self-explanatory. huntakiller.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Like I say, all of those... we have links to all of those ads in our podcast description. If you're a member of the program, you won't hear those ads, but you can go and check out the deals that we have and then check out the websites. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We cut out the ads. We give you extra content every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You support the free show and we give you extra bonuses. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Robert Kuttner, founder of the American Prospect, on the stakes 2020 and the survival of American democracy. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect, former columnist for Business Week, Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Ida and Meyer Kirstein Chair at Brandeis University, and author of his latest, The Stakes 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. Robert Kuttner, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I hope that the this audience perceives the stakes here, at least in the immediate sense. Just walk us through how you perceive Donald Trump has, for lack of a better term, grown in this office, and why he is on a trajectory that, if reelected, becomes that much worse.
You know, what's really bizarre is that on the one hand, he's become more psychiatrically impaired And on the other hand, he's become more competent at subverting American democracy. So, for instance, for the first couple of years, he had minders. He had mainstream minders at the Justice Department as White House chiefs of staff. He had the three generals who were at the Pentagon and at National Security Administration, Homeland Security. After his first 2 years in office, he shook all of them off. You know, Steve Bannon was worried that the so-called deep state would constrain Donald Trump. Well, the deep state is not doing that as effectively as it did. The offsetting news, of course, is that despite all the messing with democracy, the Democrats were able to flip 43 Republican House seats. So at least you now got one House that is able to investigate Trump, and he doesn't have wall-to-wall control of the government. But there are so many things that he could do in a second term that he hasn't quite gotten around to yet, that he hasn't figured out yet. I mean, he's trying to get control of the police agencies, the IRS, the FBI, the CIA. He's sort of done that. He hasn't totally done it. He could launch an all-out war against the press through prosecutions under the 1917 Espionage Act, where reporters would be vulnerable for prosecutions if they happen to refer to classified material, which they have a perfect right to do if they haven't signed a national security oath. And I go through all the stuff in the book that he could do in a second. He could go after nonprofits. He could sick the IRS on nonprofits and get them caught up in technical violations. And of course, progressive groups are much more dependent on nonprofit status than conservative groups who have all the corporate money they need. So the alarmist part, I don't think your listeners need a tutorial on that. I mean, we all know all of the things to be alarmed about if Trump wins a second term. I think the more important part of the book is the argument that in order to win, and to win big, and to win beyond the margin of theft, the Democrats need to nominate an economic progressive, because it's those issues where Trump was able to steal the Democrats' clothes in 2016, and it's those issues where a progressive Democrat can really draw a distinction between what we stand for and what he stands for, and win back some of those voters who defected to Trump on social issues, on identity issues, on issues where Hillary was correctly perceived to be in bed with Wall Street. And voters just concluded that they're all a bunch of scoundrels, and I might as well vote for somebody who's going to blow it up, and maybe I'll get some of the pieces.
Or I think maybe even more substantial is those people who said they're both scoundrels, I'm staying home. Or I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the presidency blank. There was a tremendous amount
sure.
of those type of votes in Wisconsin.
Participation was way down.
Right. But before we get to that, let's just go. I just want to go back. Like when we talk about his subversion of democracy, like where is the delineation between just policy sets that are indicative of what's been happening over the past 40 years? And you know, that are making our country sort of like, I don't know how to articulate this, more softly less democratic, right? Like just less egalitarian, I guess, on some respect, or where the spoils of society are being hoarded by few, and where the costs and responsibilities of society are being dispersed specifically to those who are not getting the spoils of society, as it were. And
there are...
Well, yeah, I mean, where do you delineate? Like, is all that anti-democratic, or are you talking about like specific institutions when you talk about he could be taking over the IRS or he could be attacking specifically?
Yeah.
I mean,
Sam, it's a very important distinction. And my whole point in this book is that there's a connection between these two things. So on the one hand, you know, you have rule of law, due process, courts as an independent branch of government, all that stuff. And we know how Trump runs roughshod over that. On the other hand, we have all the stuff that's been going on over the past 30 years where concentrated economic power turns into concentrated political power, which gives economic elites more power to rig the rules against regular people so that they get more and more of the spoils and ordinary people get less and less of a reasonable share of the economy. Now, those things came together in 2016. And I think they need to be attacked as a common problem. That's why I think it's so important that we nominate and elect a progressive, because if you can run the economy in such a way that it's not so highly concentrated, that Wall Street doesn't get to make all the rules, that regular people get more benefit, then, you know, people start believing in democracy again. It's no accident that there was no support for dictatorship anywhere in the West in the 30 or 40 years after World War II, because the economy was delivering for regular people. And that, in turn, meant that the political system had some legitimacy. And when the economy loses legitimacy, the political system loses legitimacy. So you got to take back both things at the same time and turn what has been a vicious circle back into a virtuous circle.
And to be fair, I mean, we're also talking post-World War II. We're also talking the world had a fairly bad taste in its mouth about dictators and authoritarians. And also, I think, at least in this country, there, you know, not everybody was participating in this great expansion, this economic expansion, or at least in terms of like, you know, political participation. And so what, I mean, how much, I mean, before we go sort of like forward as to what the solution is, how much responsibility do you perceive Democrats in having a stake or a role in what culminated with Donald Trump? I mean, on some level, the leap, you know, Donald Trump wins by a razor thin, almost impossibly thin margin, I guess maybe 2000 was also pretty razor thin. But the fact of the matter that it was that close, that you have the ability for a fluke like that to happen, is indicative of something really going off the rails in American society. I mean, you just mentioned the what Trump could do in terms of prosecuting journalists. The Obama administration more or less did the same, it seems to me, or pretty darn close, and certainly set the table. How much of the Democrats up to this point have, how much responsibility do they bear in what has happened in the past, I don't know, 30, 40 years?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So if you start with Clinton, really, or even to some extent with Carter, who was a big supporter of deregulation of the economy and did not do much, if anything, for trade unions, you had three presidencies in a row where on civil rights issues, Democrats were pretty good, but on economic issues, they were terrible. They were okay on the environment. They were okay on a few other issues. But on the big question of who governs capitalism, Bill Clinton was worse than either President Bush in terms of taking the lead on deregulating Wall Street, which in turn led to the collapse of 2008, which in turn screwed more than 10 million homeowners, and really came back to haunt Mrs. Clinton in 2016. And Obama, who really had an opportunity, right? He, I mean, he's elected president mainly because the economy collapses on George W. Bush's watch. And, you know, the economy collapses in September of 2008. And the Republican nominee, John McCain, does a terrible job of presenting himself as a persuasive leader in an economic crisis, and Obama looks pretty good. So he gets elected. And what does he do? He appoints Bill Clinton's team, the same guys who gave us deregulation, Geithner, Summers, Bernanke, to fix it. And what do? Instead of breaking up the banks, they bail out the banks. So on the big economic issues that cost Democrats credibility with ordinary working people, the Democrats were about as bad as the Republicans. And what happened in 2016, and Steve Bannon was the master strategist there, I mean, you meld together economic nationalism with resentment on the part of working people that their economic status has gone down the drain. That's all mixed together with cultural resentments about women, about African Americans, and you package it so that it's resentment against the status quo, and a lunatic like Trump can get elected president. And Hillary is frosting on the cake. She's taking $500,000 speaking fees from Wall Street, and people say, you know what the hell, they're all the same, Democrats, Republicans, let's vote for a complete outsider. So on the question of economic concentration and ordinary working people not getting a decent shake, Democrats are equally culpable. On the issue of whether you honor process democracy, I think the Republicans are a lot worse. I mean, Gingrich and then McConnell, you know, they ran the show so that there was no legitimate role for the opposition party. They played much rougher on the Supreme Court. They made much more abusive use of emergency presidential power. And so on the process issues, the Democrats were better. But unfortunately, you don't get elected as a process liberal. You get elected based on whether you're perceived as delivering for ordinary people. And on that basis, the Democrats got into bed with Wall Street. And Trump was the result. So my point is, we better not repeat that in 2020. And when Joe Biden says, well, Trump is an aberration, we got to return to normal, the answer to that is, hey, normal wasn't good enough. Normal, economically, was what elected Donald Trump.
So, I want to go further into that that question as to why, as to, you know, how you see this playing out with the election. I mean, we're already starting to see some of Biden's support start to, drop as more and more people. I think the latest I've seen is 9% of Democratic voters have made up their mind for sure. So there's a lot of fluidity in where people are, although it seems to be still sort of maintained around the top three candidates. Just play this out for us. I mean, Joe Biden supposedly appeals to these, we're told anyways, appeals to the Midwesterners who abandoned the Democrats or who didn't show up for the Democrats. We also know that he has a certain amount of appeal amongst older African-American voters, which is substantial. They're obviously a major cohort in terms of supporting Democrats. I mean, what is the formula here, aside from just sort of if what you're saying is the case, that people don't want to return to normal, why are we not seeing that quite yet?
Well, you are really starting to see it. So let's take them one at a time. I mean, Biden... You know, Biden barely holds it together. I mean, Biden is kind of past his pull date, leaving aside where he is on the issue.
Well, right. I mean, I think that is actually sort of like let's put that aside for a moment, because I do think that actually ultimately may be the most important factor, because even the people who support Biden's issue sets, I think, are starting to sort of say, like, this is a guy who is, I keep using this phrase, leaking oil. This may not be the best vehicle even for our, even for this specific issue set, but putting that aside.
Well, but stay on that for a second, because you really can't put it aside. I mean, the candidate as a person becomes bundled with the candidate's views
right.
on the issues. And because he keeps tripping over himself, it's not even clear where he stands on some issues. I also think, you know, this business with Trump, trying to use the Ukrainians to investigate Hunter Biden is really going to hurt Biden as well as Trump, because it's going to reinforce this notion that they're all a bunch of scoundrels. Trump has kids who are corrupt. Well, maybe Biden has a kid who's corrupt, and they're all a bunch of scoundrels. And I think this is going to hurt Biden, independently of all the other stuff that's going to hurt Biden. The other thing that's going on is that Warren is really very interesting. I mean, the Des Moines Register poll came out on Sunday, and it shows the first choice of Iowa voters likely to vote in the precinct caucuses, 22 for Warren, 20 for Biden, 11 for Sanders. And there's this mysterious quality called momentum, and Warren seems to have it, and the other two don't seem to have it. And just let me also speak to the question of older African-American voters. You know, you take a lot of this is the Obama halo effect, and you start taking a closer look at Obama's record on race, whether it's school integration or whether it's strong prison, long prison sentences, or whether it's tactically getting into bed with some pretty nasty Republican senators, the more and more that comes to light, I think the more his support among African Americans is going to dwindle. There was a piece in the Times, I think yesterday, about younger African Americans trying to persuade their parents and their grandparents that Biden ain't so great. And as more and more attention is focused on the election, I think you're going to see more and more of that happening. Warren is interesting in this regard because, you know, for 15 years, she has been fighting the banks on the whole question of fair mortgages for African Americans, and the kind of second tier leadership in the black community is very, very aware of that. So I think the expectations are so high for the Southern primaries on Super Tuesday, where about 60% of the electorate in the Democratic Party is African American, that if Biden underperforms there, that's going to be devastating. And I think the expectations are so high that I don't see how he can possibly meet them. To me, the thing I most worry about is the point at which Bernie Sanders realizes that his nemesis is Elizabeth Warren. And then what happens? Because both of them can't get nominated. And then how ugly and nasty does it get? I mean, Democrats, you know, are famous for doing each other in and screwing up a sure thing. And we've never had a situation where we had an embarrassment of riches on the progressive side. So now we got two front runners who are both progressives. And how does that play out?
I mean, it seems to me that that Elizabeth Warren without Bernie Sanders in the race, and it's quite conceivable, right, that Elizabeth Warren could find that Bernie Sanders is her nemesis as well at one point.
They cancel each other out. That's right.
They cancel each other, but they also protect each other, it seems to me, because if it was just Warren and Biden right now in the race, or just a Sanders and Biden in the race, I think that that they would be under constant assault.
I agree with you, and it's almost like a prisoner's dilemma: which one of them defects first and starts, you know, having their surrogates snipe at the other one. This happened last week when Sanders was asleep at the switch and Warren won the Working Families Party endorsement, and there was a lot of sniping in the Twitter sphere and a lot of sniping in the left wing press that this endorsement was somehow underhandedly stolen from Sanders, because the Working Families Party did endorse Sanders last time. So you're going to the more, if in fact Warren continues to overtake Sanders, and there's every evidence that could well happen, you know, you're going to see more and more of this sniping. But they do protect each other in the following sense. I mean, even though Warren chooses not to call herself a socialist, she's every bit as radical on the whole question of how you reform American capitalism and what you do about it as Sanders is. And in some respects, she's better at it because she's a closer student of it. You know, Bernie's kind of a socialist from 30,000 feet, whereas Warren has spent the last 20 years really looking at the details of American capitalism up close and personal, which is why she's got all these highly detailed plans on what to do. And it's very funny. Some people kind of on the center left who I talk to sort of say, well, at least Warren isn't as bad as Sanders. Well, just between us and your listeners, if you were Goldman Sachs, Warren is every bit as bad as Sanders and probably a lot more effective.
I think that's true in the context of Goldman Sachs, but let me ask you, this is a nice segue into a question that I have. And I think there's a lot of folks who would say, it is the case that Warren is for, a lot of reform, extreme, reform and regulation. Antitrust is, I think, is a big part of that, and diminishing the power of capital by making them, providing more competition amongst them. What do you say to those people who say that Sanders fundamentally is for a greater restructuring a greater assault on the structures that inevitably keep bringing us back to this place? I mean, because if, let's say, you know, Piketty's argument is that rather than us straying from where we were during the Great Compression, that, you know, those years, that the Great Compression was actually an anomaly, that under the context of capitalism as we're currently structured, that it is inevitable that we're going to go back to society, that you can undo regulations. We just talked about Bill Clinton deregulating the banks, that we certainly saw the regulatory framework of Obama being unraveled, that you need to have much bigger, bolder programs that are sustainable, and that Sanders' approach is a little bit more universal in the way that he configures these programs.
Let me address both parts of the question. So I think if you look at the details of Warren's strategy for restructuring how corporations are organized, what they have to do, if you look at her plan for cutting private equity off at the knees, if you look at what each of them would do for trade unions, if you look at what each of them would do to break up economic concentration, Warren is every bit as radical as Sanders and probably a lot better on the details. But let me come back to this Thomas Piketty question. He's a very good statistical historian. He's a lousy political economist. And he leaves out politics. You know, the reason that the income distribution got more equal between Roosevelt and LBJ was for one simple reason. Working people were mobilized, and progressives were the dominant tendency in American politics. Now, the Vietnam War screwed that up. I mean, it sort of broke the New Deal, Great Society coalition into hard hats and hippies, and then a little bit later, you had backlash against the effort by Johnson to pass civil rights legislation. But the whole story of the post-war boom in Europe and the U.S. is that when the working class is mobilized, you can fight capitalism to a draw. You can regulate the hell out of it. You can have strongly empowered trade unions. You can have a lot of social income. And lo and behold, you can keep capitalism in its box, where entrepreneurship creates innovation, but the financial elites don't run the whole political economy. So I think the hope here is that you mobilize regular people, you get them to appreciate that they have common class interests which transcend racial division, so that Trump and Bannon can't play their game of racial division, and you take back the politics, and then you take back the economy. That's the hope. It's not easy, but it's possible.
But if you get to that point, why would you allow, I mean, if you look at capitalism's power like a balloon, right, where you're basically saying, like, you know, that under the right circumstances, if people garner enough and generate enough political strength, they can match capitalism to a draw. But isn't that really one half of the argument as to why you should actually have more structural change? Because that you, if you have that ability at that moment, why not, instead of deflating the tire, why not just put a big hole in it and not allow that tire to reflate?
Well, look, I mean, people like me are in favor of a good deal of direct public ownership. Right. There's a wonderful book that I recommend by Ganesh Sitaraman, who's one of Warren's chief advisors, called Public Options, where Ganesh says, OK, let's have public banking. Let's have public banking through the post office. Let's have public Medicare. Let's have public this. Let's have public that. And by having more and more of the economy offering public options to compete with private options, you know, that's a kind of socialism. I mean, Roosevelt was for this. Roosevelt was for public power. Roosevelt was for public role in banking. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't include some socialistic aspects of this. But, you know, unless you want the government to take over the whole economy, which I don't think is what most Americans want, I do think it's possible to have an economy that has a lot of public ownership, a lot of public regulation, and the single most important part of this is strongly empowered workers, because that's where you get your political majority. And we have a historic record that this can actually work. But you need your people mobilized politically all of the time, because if the economy is even partly capitalistic, the capitalists claw back a lot of power. And that's the story of the last 40 years. So you're right. But I'm not sure where your tire metaphor goes. You need to really limit their political power. You need to constrain what they can do economically. You need to countervail it with public institutions. But, I'm not a Bolshevik. I mean, I don't think you put the private sector out of business. And I don't even think Bernie Sanders thinks that.
No, I would agree. I mean, I think, I guess it's more about places where you, questions that, I think at one point Warren was asked the question about climate change. And it was framed in the question of climate change, which I think it's sort of less relevant, but about nationalizing the power distribution in this country.
Yep.
And that is an example of to me, my mind, and I agree with you. I not only would I be against it, I don't think Bernie Sanders is close to saying that there shouldn't be markets or, you nationalize everything. But it's a question of like which power centers, things that generate the ultimately what becomes a plutocracy, do you say like this is how we're going to pull the hole in that tire? We're not going to allow you to accumulate this much power, and we're going to do it in such a way that that is more structural, that Robert Bork 2.0 can't come back in and redefine what antitrust means, and therefore this is not going to be so easily reversible.
Well, public power is a very good example. I mean, public power is more efficient than private power. It's also more environment friendly. So I'm all in favor of expanding public power and reducing privately owned power companies, but the way to keep Robert Bork 2.0 from coming back in is to make sure that you don't elect presidents who are going to appoint guys like Bork. And there's another case, by the way, where the Democrats were every bit as bad as the Republicans. I mean, antitrust was euthanized under Democrats as well as Republicans. It's another case of both parties getting into bed with Wall Street. So I think, there are some things you need to do structurally to put capitalism back in its box. The way you do that is to get elected.
Right.
And the way you get elected is to motivate and mobilize people that you're going to make a constructive difference in their lives.
And I should just say, we had Ganesh Sitaraman on the program back in 2017. We were talking about the crisis of the middle class constitution. But maybe we should have back on for this this latest book, because it sounds fantastic. All right. Well, let me. So with that said, and I think, I think this country would be so much better off. It would be such a massive upgrade in my mind, whether it's Bernie or Warren as the president. And the prospect this week has come out with an extended edition on what can be done literally on day one in terms of executive action. And we're going to be talking to David Dayan on Wednesday about that. But let me ask you this, since we're this is so oriented towards the 2020 election. I think we're on the same page in terms of our concern about Biden and our hopes for someone from the progressive wing of the party to win the nomination and ultimately the presidency. Where do you see impeachment fitting in this? Like, how problematic, or maybe you don't think it is at all, that Nancy Pelosi is basically, as far as I can tell, trying to play like a four corners game, starting almost before halftime?
Yeah, I think everything changed this weekend. I have said for a long time that I think bring it on. I mean, I think impeachment is a good thing to do, because it keeps Trump on the defensive, and it puts all of his various sins into the spotlight, and then it puts the Senate on the Republican Senate on the defensive going into an election How can you possibly be defending this guy? Now, Pelosi, I think because the more centrist Democrats were nervous about this, was trying to keep peace in the caucus. But I think this weekend, the evidence that came out of Trump using a foreign government, not only using a foreign government, but threatening a foreign government with the withholding of aid, unless they went after one of his political opponents, that has to push Pelosi over the line. And one by one, in the last 24 hours, you've had more centrist Democrats saying, "I'm sorry, this is too much," and I will be amazed if this doesn't turn into a full-blown impeachment investigation with Pelosi's support. Yeah, she had to be dragged kicking and screaming, but I think now she's going to be on board with that, and I think that's nothing but good, because I think when Trump is seriously on the defensive, he does crazier and crazier stuff, and I think it puts Republicans in a real box when they're asked, how can you possibly defend this guy? And, you know, this was exactly the trajectory that Watergate followed, that for the first 2 years, people who favored impeachment were thought of as fringe, and then it gradually became mainstream, and then it became inevitable.
Let me ask you this, because you've been watching this stuff and you've been closer to it, I think, over the years than most. Where is Chuck Schumer? I mean, maybe I'm letting my bias show a little bit, but I mean, is it possible that Nancy Pelosi? I mean, one of the things that we saw during the immigration funding that happened a couple of months ago, that Pelosi had a bill. It went to the Senate. It got shattered and then came back, and she had to accept what came from the Senate. And it caused a pretty big rift between her and some of the squad and others. To what extent do you think Nancy Pelosi is just concerned that Chuck Schumer can't deliver the majority or enough of a majority of his own caucus in the Senate? I mean, nobody expects Mitch McConnell to do anything. But if Mitch McConnell holds a vote and five or six Democrats, and I don't know who they would be, but, decide to vote with the Republicans against impeachment. I mean, is it possible that Nancy Pelosi is just afraid that Chuck Schumer can't do his job?
Well, Pelosi is a better progressive. There's two parts of this. She's a better progressive than Schumer is, and she happens to be the speaker in a chamber that has a Democratic majority, so that her job is somewhat easier. Schumer is more of a Wall Street Democrat than Pelosi, and he's got a minority, and he can't hold his caucus. So, you know, on a bad day, you've got as many as 13 or 14 centrist Democrats in the Senate who will vote with Republicans. There was an amendment last year to weaken the Dodd-Frank Act, and 14 Democrats in the Senate defected and voted with the Republicans. Why? Because they thought that this was inside baseball, that their constituents really didn't care about, you know, the detailed regulations, and they could get away with this vote and satisfy their donors. So this is tough stuff. On the other hand, if Trump is really on the ropes, they revert to partisan Democrats, and they would like to be the majority. And if the Republicans suffer a serious defeat in 2020, it's more likely that the Democrats take majority control of the Senate. There are now 11 Republican-held seats that are considered vulnerable in play in 2020. There's only one Democratic seat, the Alabama seat, and even that seat may be okay if Roy Moore gets the Republican nomination again. So even though Schumer is something of a Wall Street guy, doesn't totally control his own caucus, he would much rather be majority leader than be minority leader. And I think that partisan impulse comes to the fore once the House actually votes impeachment, and then it's up to the Senate.
Why is this generation of Democrats so – why is that partisan impulse so dead inside them, it seems to me? Like, I mean, ideologically, someone like AOC is, I think, at least it appears to the left of them. But what really strikes me is that she's also much more ferociously aggressive in terms of partisanship.
I don't. I don't think it's just generational. I mean, Sherrod Brown, who's, I think, 66, is among the most progressive Democrats in the Senate. Elizabeth Warren is 70. Bernie's going to be 78. So, yeah, to some extent, a new generation, the AOC generation, can rediscover a kind of grassroots radicalism, and that's great. I think the so many of the Democrats in the Senate are basically corporate Democrats, and it's a reflection of all the power that Wall Street has and the relative destruction of the labor movement. But you get people mobilized. You can elect progressive Democrats. Look at Montana. I mean, some very unlikely places have been able to send progressives to the Senate. But when Wall Street has so much power, in a lot of states, the Democrat, you know, will try and raise a lot of corporate money. And then if you raise a lot of corporate money, you can't be all that left wing. And then you've got a centrist faction that pulls down the Democrats as a progressive party. That's why you get a majority leader like Chuck Schumer, who's Wall Street's guy in Washington.
Well, Robert Kuttner, the stakes 2020 and the survival of American democracy, I guess we'll have a better notion within a couple of months as to what the trajectory, I think, of this race is. Lastly, let me just ask you this. What do you think the chances are for a brokered convention? I mean, this comes up every year, but it sort of feels like to me that I can imagine a Joe Biden saying, like, I'm not going to drop out. Bernie Sanders, I don't know why he would drop out. He seems like he's going to have donors all the way through. I imagine that Elizabeth Warren will as well. And certainly from I can understand, you know, I mean, Biden seems to be sort of somewhat rigid in his thinking. Warren could theoretically be extremely well positioned, and Sanders could be thinking like, at the end of the day, I need to, I'm building a movement. And so this is, you know, I'm not just running for president. I'm building a movement still. What do you think the chances are for a brokered convention?
Well, first of all, I think by March or April, there's probably only going to be about five people still in it. And with the 15% rule, you got to win 15% of the vote in a given state to have any delegates at all. So maybe there are going to be five people with delegates if Buttigieg stays moderately strong and if Kamala stays moderately strong. So then the question is, what does the horse trading look like? And who's the front runner? So if Elizabeth Warren is the front runner, and I think she will be. I mean, I would bet that she'll have more delegates than anybody else, even if she comes into the convention without a majority. So then how does this play out? I mean, what could she offer Buttigieg? What could she offer Harris? What, for that matter, could she offer Bernie? And can you imagine any scenario? I mean, let's say, I'm making this up, but let's say Warren has 40% of the delegates and Biden has 30 and Bernie has 25. So everybody else is to the right of Bernie. I can't imagine a scenario where he's the nominee. I certainly can't imagine a scenario where Biden's the nominee because everybody else is to the left of him. So you just get a lot of horse trading. I mean, maybe there's somebody who has enough delegates that Warren puts that person on the ticket as vice president, and that gives her 50 plus one. But whether it's a brokered convention, meaning we get through the first ballot and nobody has a majority and then the horse trading starts for real, I think an awful lot of the horse trading is going to happen after the last primary but before the convention. I would still think the odds are we will know who the nominee is on day one of the convention, but that might not happen. I think there's a better chance that we won't know and that it does go more than one ballot than at any time in the last 50 years. Last time this happened was 1952. I mean, we thought this was going to happen in 60, but Kennedy got to the W's before he had a majority. So you got to go back to 52 before you had a convention that went more than one ballot.
The Stakes 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. Robert Kuttner, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. There it is, folks. We got to turn the air conditioning back on. It was a little rough getting there. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. It seems to me it's quite possible. Sanders also might have more delegates going into that convention. Just turned on the air conditioner, and there was a very strange, rickety noise in there. I think that fan is getting...
It went away the last time.
Yeah, we'll just wait for it to work itself out. But there you have it. There, I have yet to meet anybody who is not nervous about Joe Biden. I mean, granted, Kuttner comes from, you know, the more progressive side of the party, but it's hard to meet people really in any place in the party who are not worried about Joe Biden.
It's almost like conventional wisdom, it seems like.
Honestly, it's not quite conventional wisdom because nobody's saying it out loud. Nobody wants to be the first one, I think, who are sort of like in the centrist clique to say that Joe Biden has lost a step. And this is not to say, when I was comparing the squad to the Democratic leadership, what I'm really talking about is not necessarily just a function of age. This is separate from Biden, but it's a function of like when people attained power. The fact of the matter is Bernie, Warren, Sherrod Brown, they have not been power players in the Senate for the vast majority of their careers. I mean, Warren, you know, coming in, it's just not, they haven't been in that position. More recently, I think, you know, all of them have been ascendant, but, and so there's a generational problem in terms of the leadership in the Democratic Party, I think without a doubt. And with Biden, I think it's like, look, you can be, I don't know how old Biden is, 70, 78, 76, 76. You could be 78 and be spry.
76. He turned 77 on November 20th.
Yeah. I think Bernie's actually older than him. And I just don't think that anybody could sit down with those two guys, regardless of what you think of their politics, and say they're aging at the same rate. It's just not the case. And while I, you know, first order for me is Joe Biden's policies in terms of who I would prefer, his ability, which I think is now unique amongst Democrats, to lose in the general election is becoming more and more prominent in the things that are keeping me up at night. With that said, folks, you don't need to know all the things that keep me up at night. You really don't want to. You don't want to know. One of those is how to fashion a better appeal to join the Majority Report. Should I say just jointhemajorityreport.com or go to jointhemajorityreport.com and join the Majority Report? Just pennies a day. You support the free part of this program, and then we give you extra content every day. And we throw in, you know, every now and then when we remember, we got to get our systems in place more to do the archive, deep archive thing. Maybe David, our Majority Report fellow, can just remind everybody about that.
Yeah, who I don't think we introduced last week when he was here his first day, but
we'll introduce launch. Him soon. Soft yeah. Launch for that fellowship.
A little Easter egg if you want to go back and watch last week's episode.
There you go. Jointhemajorityreport.com. All sorts of member benefits as well as supporting this free show. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. We have a logo, or we've just about landed on our AM Quickie logo, which means that we're so close to launching on the other, on its own feed. And when we do, you got to sign up for that because I don't know. I guess it would, you know, sign up before it on like Stitcher or whatever your podcast app is so that we can push it up to the top. I don't know if iTunes is still doing their podcast ratings anymore. They seem to be all messed up.
Yeah, it's a ghost town over there.
Also, Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience with every delivery or episode, as they call it. You dive deeper into what it's like to being a detective. without all the hassle from your family, like, you know, what are you doing? Why are you locking yourself in the room? Like, because it's not, you're not really a detective. But you're sifting through piles of documents, evidence, case files until you crack the case. This is like those situations where like people start smoking cigarettes. So they just come in I don't know. Right now, you just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hard to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Check out TMBS on its YouTube channel or wherever your podcasts are served. Also, The Antifada, available on patreon.com/TheAntifada. And Matt?
Coming up on Literary Hangover soon, I'll let Cornel West introduce the next figure we're talking about.
Wow. It's not going to be a matter of just pointing out white supremacy. Of course, white supremacy is fundamental foundation in part of the country. It's not the only foundation, because you got resistance to white supremacy. You got Lydia Maria Child. She wrote a book in 1834 called An Appeal for That Class of Americans Called Africans. It was deeply influenced by one of the greatest works ever written at that time by David Walker, Appeal to Colored Citizens of the World. She's a white sister. She is as vanilla as Doris Day in the 1830s, fundamental part of the black freedom movement, right? Mm. Well, you see, those folk need to be lifted up, because what does that do? That exposes our humanity in terms of the choices we make.
Yeah, so I'll be talking about Lydia Maria Child. She was born in Medford, Mass., another author from the Massachusetts area.
Sweet.
And she wrote a book called Hobomok, which is sort of scandalous because it involves an interracial marriage between a colonial woman and a Native American, and they have a child. And then the English man, the woman actually, and originally loved, comes back, and the Native American gives up her son and or his son and walks west. So it's still Jesus. Problematic, but she was an early SJW, people might say, and she was rather important. So I talk about her, or at least her early life, in the next episode.
Dude had to give up the child?
Yeah, he's like, she's still... like prays for you in her sleep, so I'm just gonna go head off, and he says, with the red men in the west. And that's Yeesh. It's very the inevitable sort
Different
of like
era.
Cultural genocide right. myths were even among the liberals back then.
Eef. Great.
But she was an ally, and she got better over time. That was she wrote that when she was about like 23, so
that's pretty good. There was not even people forget that the abolitionists, like a huge percentage of the abolitionists, probably the majority of the abolitionists, they weren't necessarily for black rights.
Yeah, they started off, a lot of them, like, let's get them into Liberia.
Right. We can send them away or do this and that.
Because clearly we can't, you know, coexist with
right.
them.
Right. These things take time. I guess. Quick break, fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa.
I had my my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.